Okay, good. So now we got Odin, and we're on track. And Odin's asking the question, whether God is, which maybe seems like a stupid question, but maybe not. So, I don't know, initial thoughts or reactions to your reading in this chapter, what your thoughts were as you're working your way through this, or your reactions. Yes, Kevin.
I just thought that the way he laid it out made a lot of sense. You know, his arguments to refute all those things that we hear against us made a lot of sense to me.
All right, good. So you found it compelling. Good. That was the idea. Jeff, you saying it was a lot to get through?
A lot to get through, a lot to keep straight.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in here. All right. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting how he started it by faith comes first.
Yes.
And I thought that was really important to all these arguments because it kind of alleviates the need to refute them immediately.
Yes.
And you can kind of take them for what they're really saying and trying
to
say.
This is critical. We're going to spend a little bit of time thinking about this. This is an important point. All right. Nathan, put your hand.
I was going to ask, does he talk about the problem of evil elsewhere? Because it seems like
he does.
One main negative objection to all of these should get more than a paragraph.
Yes. No, he has a whole section devoted to that. And he talks more about theodicy. Odin actually comes down doing a little more theodicy stuff than I think he should. I mean, Plaker would be disappointed in him. And he's doing a little more of that. And there's even a little taste of that here already, where you see him starting to talk about how, hey, these things all work out, it's all cool. And it's like, oh, careful now here, Odin. You're maybe to a point, but be careful. So he's doing a little bit of that. But yes, he does take that up later. And I don't know if I even have you guys read that part, to be honest, because I find him a little disappointing on that stuff. Plaker handled it a little better. All right. So let's get into this. So that we're dealing here with the issue about whether God exists. And in a sense, this could really be put underneath the category of apologetics, right? So what is apologetics? This is where we tell everybody we're really sorry that we're Christian. Yeah, this is apology, as in the apology of the Augsburg Confession. So in other words, a defense, okay? A defense. And this is what we mean by apologetics, a defense of the faith. Now, maybe you find it peculiar that you've been at the seminary now and into your second year and you've been cranking along and you were all excited when you came to the seminary because you thought, now finally I'm going to learn lots of theology and then I'll be able to win arguments on Facebook. It's going to be a blast. I can't wait. And you're just ready to go. And you get here and you haven't heard any of that stuff yet. We haven't given you much of that stuff at all. We're just talking about how cool it is to be a Lutheran and what it means, you know, and all these distinctives. And they're not good things to fight about on Facebook because nobody cares about that stuff. And it hasn't been helpful at all.
So it won't come in fourth
year? No, it won't come in fourth year either. So don't hold on. Unless you happen to take an elective course that Okamoto teaches called apologetics, then you can actually talk about it. But this is about it. We don't do a lot of this. Now, why is that? Because of what? It doesn't bring people to faith. And this is one of the interesting things about apologetics from a Lutheran standpoint is we have a rather different view about apologetics than a lot of the rest of Christendom does, or at least even the evangelical world. And so that's what we're kind of getting into today is this question about apologetics is the whole issue about does God exist is really a question of apologetics. Because we're getting into questions that the secular world asks and wonders about. Does God exist? It's an apologetic sort of question. And in our Lutheran heritage, we don't make a big deal about this. And Mark said the reason is because it doesn't bring people to faith. Fair enough. So what's the point then of doing this stuff? What is the value? Is there any value at all in asking the kinds of questions that Odin is asking in this chapter about does God exist? And then we start getting into what we call the proofs of God's existence. Is there any point of doing this? What's the value? Is there any? I made you read it. Was that just for the fun, for informative purposes? Or what's the purpose? What do you think? Actually, I can probably think of half a dozen reasons or so. So what do you guys think? What are some reasons we might do this? Francis?
Maybe to enlighten or share with other people who might have some sort of a doubt about the existence of God.
Okay. So others, as in other just unbelievers or who have a doubt about God's existence or what? What are you thinking about?
there may be unbelievers, and there may be people from a different religion.
Okay. All right. So we're going to go first. We'll offer this reason would be to essentially to pre-evangelize. Well, I guess we can call it that. That's not a bad way. So I kind of have a pre-evangelism. And the way I portray this is the value here is it has a way of breaking down a barrier or a kind of a defense mechanism they have built up. So yeah, I'll go ahead and unpack this a little more, tell you what I mean. My opinion on the apologetic value of this kinds of stuff or the evangelistic value is pretty limited. And we need to talk about that more. But the reason I think it's limited is that, as Mike said, this doesn't create faith. What does create faith? Proclamation of the gospel creates faith. So doing good apologetics does not create faith. And this is one of the huge mistakes of some of our evangelical brothers and sisters. They have this sort of idea that, hey, if you make a really good, solid argument and you give that to an unbeliever, they're going to have to, you know, yield to the weight of that argument, and they're going to have to confess Christ. So read this book, and we'll talk when you get done. And you're just kind of, you know, just waiting, because you know when they read it, they're going to have to come back and say, wow, I'm a Christian now. Yeah, I knew that would happen. That book's pretty good, isn't it? See, you just read the right one, whether it's C.S. Lewis or, you know, MacArthur or whatever your faith guy happens to be, Strobel, you know, whoever your guy is. Hey, this one's it. Read it. It's so cool, and it's going to make you a Christian. And then you have your unbeliever read it, and he says, whatever, you don't care. You're all disappointed. So the problem is that the apologetics used as evangelism is making what big mistake? They're making the mistake of functioning like a modernist. Now see, put this back into your Plaker lens and think about this a little bit. Modernity says man can figure stuff out, things have to make sense, and we've got to be able to go toe-to-toe and make good arguments. And so in a modernist world, it's saying, hey, God doesn't exist and here's the reasons. Boom, 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 boom. What's the response of good, faithful people? Oh, yes, he does, and here are the reasons. Boom, 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 boom. We win. Now, see, that's a modernist view. That's what a modernist would do. He would say, hey, you can't say that about God. Let me tell you what's really going on. And away you go. And then you start having your big confrontation. And you're playing by the modernist rules of empirical evidence, logical conclusions, a priori thinking, and all the sorts of things that modernists love to do. That's exactly what most of apologetics is doing. Look, we can win that fight. Let's go. We can win this fight. All right? And so the problem is this. That doesn't create faith. What it does is it wins a fight on modernist terms, maybe, if you're better at arguing than the other guy. But it doesn't create faith. And even if you win the argument, you're probably not going to create faith. You're probably just going to create an enemy, someone who's really ticked off at you because you made him look stupid. And he's not going to be like, oh, thanks so much for enlightening me. Does that happen? Is that how most of your conversations end? No, that was a really nice interchange. You really helped me to see things in a new way. Thanks so much. Appreciate that. No, people usually get entrenched and they just get ticked off.
If you ever have time, I can't think of who it was that did it, but there was a video that was anti-abortion that used this apologetic type thing, mm-hmm. comparing it to the Holocaust and Nazis. Mm-hmm. And he's going in the street and interviewing people for 35 minutes and forcing people to confess Christ by the end.
Yeah.
It's just a great example of what you're talking about, making enemies underneath, you know.
Right, in the name of evangelism, yeah. Now, so that's why. And that's probably the big reason why in the Lutheran Church we've always been somewhat ambivalent to apologetics, because we see it as usually being done for the wrong reasons. Trying to defend faith, trying to, you know, argue for why this is true. Because faith is an issue of the relationship that God claims us and creates with us, and it's not an issue of the intellectual kind of veracity of things or the empirical proof. That's not the foundation of faith. And the big danger we see among a lot of our evangelical brothers is they start using apologetics as a foundation, and that becomes really dangerous, really problematic. And so that's one of the reasons why we're hesitant. But as pre-evangelism, now here's where it could be useful. Suppose you do want to have a conversation about Christian truth to somebody, but they're trotting out all this stuff about, well, you know, there's not really a God, and, you know, it's been proven there's not, and this kind of stuff. Well, now it's helpful to be able to bring out some of the apologetic arguments and say, well, not so fast, dude. In fact, this and this and this. And you start giving them some kind of Odin sort of arguments. And then they often, what's going to be the case is they're going to go, whoa, I hadn't thought of that. And all you're really doing is you're breaking down their defense mechanism. Because for them, they just dismissed Christianity out of hand because it's archaic, it's stupid, it's superstition, and it's been proven not to be true, so who needs to pay attention to it anymore? And if you can say, not so fast, what's actually the case is a lot of your scientific assumptions are also fallacious and are based on stupid thinking. And here's some other things to be thinking about. You can at least tear down that barrier of that defense. Does that mean you're going to be able to do the gospel? Don't bet on it. But at least you're going to make them give some thought or bring them to the point of having to reflect again. Well, maybe. So you don't do evangelism by apologetics, in my opinion. It doesn't work. It's not the way to go. But to at least challenge wrong presupposition, there can be a place for this. You just have to realize what you're doing and how far you can go with that and what you're really going to accomplish. Okay? So that's one purpose. All right. Now, having told you about why we don't do apologetics or why we shouldn't care about proofs for God's existence, because after all, it's just the Holy Spirit's work and God makes his claim, so why even bother with stuff? So why bother? Any other thoughts on why we might do this? Bill?
To strengthen the faith.
This is a big thing. To strengthen or I'll say even confirm the faith. So who is this helpful for then?
Christians.
Confessing Christians. People who have been claimed by Christ, who know God's truth, who read the stuff, and it's good for them. And here, I think it's a really valuable thing. And apologetics are very useful. And questions like the proof of God's existence are really important for this purpose. And I think this one is probably the number one main purpose for doing apologetics, is it's for the people in the pews. And this is not a small thing, guys. Because one of my huge complaints about the church today is that we have a lot of unthinking, rather ignorant people in the pews. And they seem to think it's okay. In fact, a lot of them are doing it by intention. Because they live their lives Monday through Saturday out there in the real world. And in the real world, what's the paradigm that runs the show? What's the narrative that's operative? Reason, science, empiricism. Things that are provable, things that are practical, things that are pragmatic. That's what runs the show out there. Reason and thinking. That's it. Then when they come to church, whoa, I've just entered a new zone. I've entered the faith zone, the no thinking zone. So check your brain at the door. You can pick it up on the way out. But for now, just go in and have a little heart experience with you and God. Because here, all those rules out there no longer apply because now we're into the spiritual realm and now we're into the metaphysics and now we're into the touchy-feely and God's doing stuff. And just kind of sit back and enjoy the story and let the feelings roll through you and get that charge for your week and be ready to go and get yourself reoriented and then you get back out there and do the real world again. Anybody function that way, you think? Huh. I think it's epidemic. I think it's all over the place out there. And so we have people who just kind of assume this is church, all the rules about thinking don't apply here, and so we don't think too hard about stuff. Or our faith might come crumbling down. That wouldn't be good because I kind of like my faith and it feels good and it's good for my family and I like it. And it's nice to go somewhere before brunch. You know, church is kind of a good part of the routine on Sunday mornings. It fits. And I hate to lose it, so let's not think too hard here. And what they are under the impression of then is that Christian faith is actually kind of for morons. It's kind of stupid, which is exactly how the media treats us, how the wider world treats us. That's Christian stuff. That's great for you guys if you need that. You know, if you're that unsophisticated, if you're still kind of benighted and believe that stuff, well, that's fine, whatever, you know, if you like that stuff. But we all know the real world is different than that, and we all know it's not that, you know, simple, and we all know. That's just the assumption. And the way that Christians get portrayed in any kind of popular TV shows or anything is always just kind of backwards, a little bit of an idiot. You know, when was the last time you saw a smart, savvy person of faith who really had his act together and knew what he was doing and was portrayed positively in any kind of media? When was the last time you saw that? You know, the smart, savvy ones are always the gay people nowadays. They're the sharp ones because we want to be sympathetic to them. They're the ones who got their act together. They're the cool ones. And Christians are always the bigots and the idiots and the ones with problems and the ones who are secretly, hypocritically child beaters or whatever else. It's always that way. Just pay attention. See how wrong I am about this. So, people in our pews have this idea that somehow they have to sort of take a step down in their Christianity and they can't think too hard about stuff because that might challenge things and, you know, the whole science versus religion thing and, boy, religion's going to lose that battle, so let's just not even go there. And they have that kind of impression. So That's where a guy like Odin and his apologetics and his proofs of God existence are actually pretty helpful, because this guy is actually doing stuff with some intellectual horsepower. And he's saying, hey, not so fast. In fact, if you're going to be a Christian, you can engage your full brain, and you should, because what you're believing isn't stupid. And the people in our pews need to know that what they're confessing isn't stupid. It's not illogical. It's not irrational. In fact, it's exceedingly rational, and it's exceedingly logical even. It does work. And people from Aristotle to Descartes to Aquinas and even, you know, C.S. Lewis and on you go have said, this stuff is compelling intellectually. And it is. And our people don't realize that anymore. They've come to believe that somehow Christianity is old and passé and just kind of can't keep up anymore. But we still hang on to it because it feels nice and we like our old, good time, old religion. And it's good for nostalgia. It's wrong. It's wrong. We need to tell people that you can handle it. Bring it on. There's nothing you need to be afraid of. All right, so we need to do this for the sake of the faithful. So I think apologetics should be read and should be produced mostly for the people in the church. And they should be able to read this stuff and say, wow, okay, that's helpful. That's important. All right, good. Other reasons why we should do this. I think there are more. Stephanie.
Using our reason to kind of search God's ways is an exercise of worship.
Yes, exactly. And Odin talks about this as love God with our minds. He says this a couple of times. That's really nicely said. We love God with our minds. And I talked about this day one or day two, the whole idea that systematic theology is worship. When you're learning things about God and thinking God's truth and thinking about things and, you know, cranking through a book like Plaker and getting your mind kind of cracked open and pushed wider open, that's worship of God. You're loving God with your mind. You're thinking God's thoughts after Him. Or the fides querens intellectum, faith seeking understanding. So that's that critical premise. Where do we start? We start with faith, and then we move to these kinds of questions. Faith is the beginning point. It's not the outcome of all this pursuit. It's the beginning point. Okay. Other ideas of why apologetics are actually useful or good, or why questions about proofs of God's existence should be pursued. Any other thoughts you might have? Yeah, Jeff.
Sometimes it raises questions that you may not have known existed. Like, oh, people actually disagree with that. And so you can kind of get into the other.
All right. So it sensitizes you to the criticisms, which can be really helpful if you're preaching or teaching or trying to, you know, actually have a conversation, to be able to know that, oh, some people might actually believe this and anticipate where they're going and where they might be thinking about it. So this actually has kind of that evangelistic purpose as well. And it can make you a better preacher, I think. All right, good? Other thoughts on why we might even do this? Yeah, Mike or Adam.
It helps to see the underlying philosophical assumptions behind various positions.
All right, we are better now at learning to identify worldviews. Or the undergirding philosophical assumptions. You know, what's a person's Weltanschauung? What's their worldview? How are they seeing the world, and where's that coming from? What's going on? And when you start to know some of these proofs of God's existence and start thinking through the criticisms, you begin to see more clearly where people are coming from, what's going on, what's directing them. All right? Good? Good? Any other thoughts? Now, we have to realize then, when we get into this whole discussion about the proofs of God's existence, are we going to actually prove that God exists? No. Can't be done. Do we get concerned about that? No, because we're not modernists. We're not playing that game. We're not all worked up about that. It doesn't matter that much to us. And just because we can't prove God, you can't disprove Him either. It's just one of those things that's the way it is. And modernity has been unable to come to a final conclusion about this because you can't study God. Remember, He is immense, immeasurable. You can't put Him into a category and make Him fit. Doesn't work that way. Right? So we have to just come to that terms and deal with that. All right. Now, we don't think we're going to be able to prove God's existence. And the other thing we have to remember is this, and this can become very clear, is as we're working our way through this list, what becomes quite evident is that the kind of God that we're getting proven here is a far cry from the God of scriptural or analogy of faith revelation, right? because the kind of God we get proven is often nothing more than sort of a, you know, a ground of being or an unmoved mover sort of a thing, or a deistic God who just, you know, winds things up and then stands back. That's usually sufficient for most of these proofs. So we have to recognize that even if we are convinced by these proofs or find them helpful, they don't bring you to Christ. They don't bring you to the triune God. They don't bring you to a confession of the full God as revealed in the scriptural account. There's a big gap between there, okay? All right. Now, if you've had some philosophical background, this stuff is all a lot easier. If you haven't, this will be a new experience for you. But we'll have fun with it anyway. Okay, good. So he gets into his whys. I think he does a nice job on this. Talks about these things. And talks about how people have just kind of taken this for granted and not been a big issue a lot of times in the past. But now we're getting into this. Page 137. I'll just flip our way through the pages now. So we should be able to do this pretty quickly. If you have questions on some particular part, raise your hand and stop me, and we'll slow down a little bit and talk about it. All right. So page 137. Halfway down the page, the classical formula is God can be known but not comprehended. That's exactly right. We had the same thing in Pieper, that we don't define God, we just describe him. And it's the same kind of idea here. We can't know God, but God can be known but not comprehended. And we had the elephant analogy, so you can kind of touch it, but you're not going to be able to get your mind around the whole thing or get the whole thing all figured out. So you're not going to ever be able to completely comprehend God. We simply know him as he reveals himself to us. That's well said, I think. All right. He also talks about the place of these arguments in 138, and this is where he has that nice point that we brought up. They are a form of loving God with our minds. They corroborate with what faith knows rather than produce or establish faith. This is exactly right. They're not, this is the bottom, last full paragraph, not independent, airtight, unchangeable proofs, but taken together, they tend to confirm and to validate what faith already knows. So what happens then for a believer is he starts hearing this stuff, and he says, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's cool. That's good. And you guys will have this experience when you start teaching stuff, and you start doing robust teaching in your parishes, and I hope you do that. You know, nothing worse in the parish than thin, crummy teaching. All right, and then what did Peter do? He got out of the boat. How do you think he felt at that moment? Oh, kind of scared, maybe a little excited, okay. Come on, is that the best we can do in our Bible classes? You know, read the text, how'd it feel? You know, teach when you have Bible class. Teach stuff, give them content. Your goal should be, I want them to know everything I know. And that means you need to know some stuff. So, make the most of your opportunity while you're here, and you keep learning. But you got to give them content. And your people in the Bible classes should be saying, yeah, that's cool. That's how that works. I see that now. And don't be afraid to get into some heavy philosophical stuff. They can handle it. Just bring them along, get them up to speed, and they'll eat it up. And the more content, and the more depth, and the more weight you can put into your stuff, you're not going to blow people off, and they're not going to be dissuaded by that. They're going to be excited by that because you're going to bring them along and help them to see why this stuff matters. And that's the way to do your teaching and make it compelling. So tell them all this stuff. This does have a place. All right. And so then we learn to love God with our minds. We have to get over this thing we have, this utterly pragmatic thing we have in our American churches of, well, there's got to be a point to Bible class. You know, what are we trying to do? And what I hate is when people criticize, well, that's just data dump. And I think, so, whoa, wait a minute. Whose data are we dumping here? God's? And so if we're talking about God's truth, that's data dump? What's wrong with just learning something about the Ganus Maiestaticum? Why does it have to have an immediate outcome for my family life? What's wrong with learning about the proofs for God's existence? Do we have to have an immediate application to just how I raise my kids accordingly? Why does it have to work that way? There's a place for simply learning God's truth and going deep and getting a better, fuller picture of things because it makes you a better, fuller person and better able to do everything else you do in life. Now, there's a place for the other stuff, too, and you can have your pragmatic classes. But don't make everything just about, you know, a better marriage in 5 easy steps or how to be a better dad or how to overcome your problems at work or understanding yourself. You know, there's a place for that, but there's a place also for just digging into God's truth. All right, good. So that's that. And I think he says it makes a really good point, very top of 139, top line. The church has never taken these arguments with absolute seriousness, as if everything hinged upon the success of our arguments about God. God does not depend upon our thoughts about God. Amen to that. You know, it's not like we have to win this argument, we have to prove these things, because God doesn't stand or fall on this, and our faith doesn't stand or fall on these things either. That's exactly where we're coming with this. All right. Good. Finally, then, he spent all these pages basically simply laying out why we're going to do this. Now, why did he spend so much time doing that? Yeah, for all the reasons we've been talking about up here. Because people don't get this. People have the wrong idea. They think that, oh, we're going to prove that God exists. Now I can win all my fights with my, you know, unbelieving friends. No, that's not why we're doing this. Or they get the wrong idea that somehow we've got to win this argument or the Christian faith collapses. No, that's not true either. You know, just because somebody writes a really compelling book that proves that God doesn't exist doesn't mean our faith goes in the tank. It doesn't work that way. Because we're not modernists. And that's why Odin spends so much time talking about all this, just doing kind of prolegomena, getting set up. All right, now he's ready, finally, at long last, to get into his discussion about the actual proofs for God's existence. And if you have studied some of this stuff somewhere along the way in your undergrad days, I doubt that there's a single argument you've ever encountered that's not included in here, which is one of the reasons I really like Odin. He is exceedingly comprehensive. Just about everything you could possibly think of, he pushes in here. Now, the way they get categorized, we might argue about that, and they can get categorized different ways, but it's not that big a deal. As Odin himself says very clearly, that the distinctions between them are, in a sense, somewhat arbitrary because they actually overlap quite a bit. And we only make the distinctions kind of just for the helpful categorizing of things and trying to keep things a little bit straight, but there's tons of overlap between them, and they filter into each other pretty freely. All right, now having said all that, let's get into our actual list. So, what's the first kind of argument he's going to talk about?
Order and design.
Order and design. And for the sake of continuity, we're going to have all these be objicles, or close. So these are teleo, whoops, I left out a couple letters. Teleological arguments. So what does teleology mean? Study of purpose. Comes from the Greek, of course, right? Telos, and a telos is an end, a goal, a purpose. It's what you're striving for. That's a telos. So teleological is arguments out of purpose, or discussion of purposes, or ends, or directions. So that's teleological. And by the way, this is a word that is used not in only in theology. It's a word that you would actually encounter in the real world, scientific kinds of things. Teleological questions are questions of purpose. What's the end? What's the purpose for something? It's more than just, you know, the end point of a race. It's kind of like, what's the goal? So if I'm an Olympic athlete, what's my telos? Yeah, gold medal. That's it. And so everything is aimed for that telos. That's what I'm for. That's my purpose. So when I'm training, when I'm eating, when I'm sleeping, when I'm doing everything I do, everything is gone aimed at that purpose, right? That telos. And that's then when an athlete wins and brings home the gold, you know, it's like it all has come together, which is why everybody loves watching the Olympics so much. And it's so much more compelling than even other sports, because now you got that gold medal kind of telos thing, and you see all the emotion. And so when they stand on the podium, and they're getting the medal ceremony, up goes the flag, it's like, it's all there, and it's all, this is it, they've hit the telos. That's the purpose, that's the end, that's the goal. So teleological arguments are arguments for the existence of God that are based on the fact that things have purpose. Things have a design. Things are put together in such a way to accomplish something. So things are purposeful. Okay? So let's talk about this one a little bit, unpack it as we go along here. So a teleological argument is going to be our first one. We'll unpack them as we get them all up here. Let's get the next one up here. So what's the next kind of argument that he's going to talk about?
Anthropological.
Yes. Anthropological arguments. And these are arguments that are going to be based on things that are reflections of God, or things we see within humanity which point to a creator, or which point to some sort of source outside of ourselves. So mind, human nature, the general consent. So these are anthropological arguments, in other words, human-based. So human-based sort of arguments. The fact that all people acknowledge a God would be an anthropological argument. All right, number three is the one that you're most familiar with, and these are the arguments we call cosmological. And by cosmos, we mean the world. And see, these are things that are based in nature. Of course, the teleological and anthropological, in a sense, are as well. That's why there's overlap. But the cosmological is we're looking at things are there, where'd they come from? This is the classic. You need to find a watch in the woods, and what do you have to assume? There must be a watchmaker, all right? And so that's a cosmological argument. Arguments from change, causality, contingency, degrees of being, these are cosmological arguments. All right, good. And then the fourth category he's going to call what? Arguments from conscience, beauty, pragmatic results, and we're going to call these generally moral arguments. Moral arguments, okay? Moral arguments, we got teleological, anthropological, cosmological, and moral. And I know that doesn't have the logical at the end, but it's close enough. So moral arguments are arguments from the sense of right and wrong. And this has to do with the issue of what is just, what is right, what is wrong, conscience kinds of things, right and wrong. And even aesthetics comes into here. Unpack that more later. And then the final kind of argument he's going to talk about is the ontological argument. Ontological argument. And that's an argument out of being. Argument from being. All right. So now let's get back to the top of our list and kind of work this way through. So the arguments from order or design, he summarizes this pretty basically on page 143. Formally, the argument may be summarized in this way. The visible world is a cosmos, an orderly unity whose order is constant, uniform, complex, and intrinsic to the universe itself. Such an order cannot be explained unless it be admitted that the universe has a cause that displays remarkable intelligence, able to understand and produce this order, and a will capable of bringing it into being. Therefore, such a cause of the universe exists, which is to say, God exists as the intelligent cause of the universe. All right. So that's a teleological. There's a purpose. There's a design for things. There must be someone who designed it and put things together. That's the idea. So we see this, for example, in like maybe the water cycle would be an example. So the rain falls, runs down into rivers, runs down the ocean, and it evaporates, goes back up. So what's the purpose of all this? The purpose is it saturates the ground and waters things so things grow. So there's a purpose to what we see going on. Things aren't happening without direction. There's an overall reason for things. Even the seasons and the cycle of the seasons. Why is the earth tilted just the way it is? Well, it allows for the fluctuation in seasons and the growing climates and keeps us from getting too cooked on one side. And, you know, all these kinds of things make a difference. And you know, you've studied this stuff, heard about it before, that if the earth's axis were tilted just slightly a little bit one way or the other, it would change everything dramatically and life wouldn't be possible and all kinds of other things, you know. And so all this stuff points to there's a purposeful plan to this order. And things are happening because there's a design behind things. There's a purpose for things. Now, this is grounded a lot in Aristotelian thought. Aristotle always liked to analyze things based on its material principles and its formal principles. And it's teleological, or the purpose, its final cause. In other words, what's the point of this thing? Everything, he would argue, has some sort of point or reason or purpose. And think about that a little bit, how big a deal this is. So does a rock have a purpose? Sure. Have mass, get warm when it's warm, and get cold when it's cold, and, you know, that's what a rock does. And a tree has a purpose, which would be to grow, produce shade, produces a great environment for all kinds of other living things, and then it reproduces itself. That's its telos. Does humanity have a purpose? Well, Aristotle would say yes. This is Aristotle would say yes. And Christians would say, yes. And one of the dilemmas that a lot of people have nowadays is they don't know. And that's the existential dilemma, which is a great evangelistic hook, actually, if you're going to talk to people about things that matter, is what's the point of life? What are you doing here? What's it all matter? And is it really the fact that you just live and you die and that's it? You know, most people who assert those things haven't thought about it very much. Because if you really believe that you just die and that's it, and you become nothing, it's completely unnerving. And then Camus and Sartre are right. And what's the point? You know, the only question left is, why not suicide? And when? What's the point? Or the other issue is, you know, why in the world would anybody ever choose to be moral if they really believed that you live and you die and that's it, and then there's no accountability beyond that? Nothing. That's the end. You know, you get away with whatever you can. And if nobody's looking, of course you get away, you do stuff, because who cares? You're not accountable. There's nothing. Who cares? See, nobody thinks about this stuff because it's just way too scary and terrifying if it was really true. And yet our world operates with this kind of weird thing that says, well, we all know God's not really true and doesn't matter, but you better be moral. What? Why? Anyway, we're getting a little farther afield. Yes, Dan.
The
teleological.
Is that the intelligent design argument that's being...
That and the cosmological kind of come together. Yes, exactly right. And so in other words, hey, it doesn't make any sense that this stuff just happened. There's got to be a reason for it. Things are too purposeful. Now, the problem, of course, though, with the teleological argument or an intelligent design is, what does it lead you? It leads you to say, there's got to be some kind of intelligence to put this together. It didn't just happen. And you've often heard this argument, and it's true. It takes as much or more faith to believe in random chance producing the world we see around us than it does to believe an intelligent maker put it together. It really does. Because, you know, you've heard the illustration that a billion monkeys, all on typewriters, could produce Shakespeare's works in order if they had infinity to do it, which is like, yeah, right. You know, but it's possible, I suppose. But how much faith does it take to believe that could happen? And how much faith does it take to believe that this world could just happen? It's a lot easier to say there must be something to put it together. That's the idea. Now, the thing is, what could put it together? Does it have to be God? It could just be some big conglomerate somewhere that builds worlds, you know? And you know what? What's that?
Or aliens.
Or aliens? No, you get this. You know, it's a science fiction kind of stuff. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, this kind of stuff, you know? So, what's that? Yeah. So, you know, one planet gets destroyed, so you got to build another one, you know. We have to wipe this planet out because it's in the way of an off-ramp or something, you know. So, well, too bad. And so, well, we'll make a new one. So we just go to the planet builders and request a new one. And, you know, sure, is that possible? Yeah, okay. So you don't have to have a benevolent God of creation, but you do have to have some sort of intelligent being. Otherwise, it becomes really difficult to explain a lot of stuff, like the design and the purposefulness of things. Mike.
And to Nathan's point that he brought up earlier, that God doesn't look very good when you look at the state of the universe, which is brutish, nasty, and short.
Right. That's the Hobbesian thing. God just tends not to look really good if you look at some parts of it. But then you can look at other parts and say, yes, that part's true, but then look at the other parts that are overwhelmingly beautiful and good. So you get that contrast there. All right, good. On page 144, as he says, the power of this argument is best seen by taking seriously its opposite hypothesis that there is no cause of order, for then one is attributing the order to chance, which in the long run still would leave the order unexplained. So where did it come from? It just happened by chance. Wow, that's kind of tough. So we have the same thing with design, that things are working with the design. Instinct is one of these my favorite things. And this is, you need to learn to appreciate this. How often do you hear on some kind of nature show where they talk about the salmon or the bear or the monarch butterfly doing these remarkable things, and then they say, and why they do this? And the answer they give is instinct. And they act like when they talk about instinct, like they've said something profoundly insightful. Like there's an instinct thing, they figured out where it is in the brain. What does instinct really mean? It means we don't have a clue as how this is happening, but it does. That's what it means. It means they don't have a clue what's going on. They don't know, it just does. Why does a salmon swim upstream? The same exact place where it was born or spawned. They don't know, it just does. Oh, it's instinct. But they act like they've made, well, we realize it's instinct. Come on, you guys are cheating. You don't know what that means. And how can a monarch butterfly know which of those 8 trees to go down to in Mexico every year? How does that work? Wow, it's just chance. It's just instinct. Well, great. But where's instinct? Is it capital I instinct? Is it like God? What is instinct? Or is it just DNA? What is it? I don't know. It cracks you up when you start listening and actually think what they're saying. That's in the point he's making, 146 to 145, 146. You'll be getting this a week from today, a lot more. Top of the page, second line. If evolutionary theory is to speak profoundly of adaptation and fitness, it must think more thoroughly about that to which the evolution of animal behavior is adapted or fitted. So in other words, if we talk about adapting and being better fit and improving, well, wait a minute. As soon as you talk about better or improve, you're implying a telos, a goal. Well, then there's got to be something there. Because if there's no telos maker, if there's no creator, there is no goal, there is no purpose, there is no improvement. What do you mean improvement? If for the person who's getting left behind, it's certainly not an improvement. It's arbitrary. And the very idea that we're somehow, mankind is advancing, even the word advance implies a telos, a standard by which you decide what's better than what was before. How do you know that? See, there's all kinds of assumptions we're making. All right, good. Arguments from humanity. The point here is, he's talking about there are certain things that we have in human nature, especially our ability to even to think, the mind that we have, our ability to recollect things and have an intelligent kind of deposit of memory. All of this stuff indicates a part of our makeup that points to something beyond ourselves. So page 149, second paragraph. The intelligibility or mind that we find everywhere in the universe could only be the result of an unsurpassably intelligent being. Reason suggests, what Scripture attests, that the one revealed as all-wise reaches out to illumine the human spirit. As the law of gravity exists prior to our discovering it, as the laws of motion are there prior to our moving anything, so must the larger intelligibility of the world exist prior to any intelligent awareness that we might have of it. So the fact that we actually learn about things is we're tapping into this intelligence that has put things there that we can actually learn. That's kind of the argument going on. Personhood, the same idea, that we have a personal nature. Our personhood comes from another place. Bottom of 152, I'm trying to keep things moving here so I have time for everything. The point, if humanity has the idea of God implanted in its very nature, then some sufficient reason must be hypothesized. Of many possible hypotheses, the most evident and plausible one is that God put it there. Although such an argument lacks the force of a demonstration or proof, it must be dislodged by some better hypothesis. See, the argument here is that man is, as the Latin phrase is, homo religioso. You may have heard that before. Homo religioso. Which means man the religious. Man the religious. Man believes in God. Across cultures, across time, man believes in God. Why? Well, the answer is because God's there, and he implanted that understanding of us into our very fabric. This is why even pagans have a sense of something more is out there. There's a God, and we have to come to terms with him. And even in American context, you look at the polling data, and the people who, is there a God? Do you believe in some kind of divine being? The vast majority of Americans say yes, 80th percentile or higher. And then those who are, flat-out atheists are small, small minority. There's plenty of people who, I'm not sure, but maybe, they have a sense of it. Typically, the reason why most people are resisting the affirmation of that is because they don't like all the implications. Because if the God actually does exist, then I guess I probably should pay attention to him, and then I maybe need to figure out what's true, and that gets complicated, and then I might actually have to change my behavior, and I kind of like my Sunday mornings the way they are, so I don't want to deal with it. So I'll just say, I don't know, God has to prove himself to me, and now it's his problem, and now I can just kind of go my merry way. That's pretty common. But they still have that sense because man is homo religioso. So where did that come from? Well, we would say, God put it there. And if God didn't put it there, then his point is, you better come up with another hypothesis. Where'd it come from? Genetic adaptation? DNA? And there are people who are coming up with ideas and they offer their solutions, but their hypotheses tend to be maybe not as compelling as the other one, which is maybe God just put it there. All right, good. And then we have, summary of this all then, 155. The burden of proof then must lie with those who wish to dismiss this evidence. It is unscientific and unreasonable to reject a hypothesis so widely affirmed, in other words, God exists, simply on the basis that it refers to something thought to be beyond scientific validation or empirical observation. Rather, belief in God might as well be regarded as presumptively true on the basis of this general consent until decisively disproved. Even if disproved, the problem would still remain of why the idea has achieved and continues to maintain such tenacity in human consciousness. Right. Okay? So that's his point. Again, this isn't going to get us to the triune God, and it's not a proof that's going to be convincing to everybody, but the argument holds. All right. Now we get to the cosmological arguments or the ideas of causality and contingency and the source of the unmoved mover or the source of everything that's happening and going on here. As I said, these are pretty familiar to most of us. They're not as unusual. But we get a nice point he makes. So this is the bottom of 159. Very last two lines. He starts to summarize this pretty well. Suppose one objects that the appearance of mind in history is merely a natural development of an essentially material evolutionary process. You hear that quite frequently. This does not, by any means, do away with the embarrassment of an unexplained cause. For there must be some plausible cause to initiate and sustain this evolving natural process. merely to stretch the development out over a long period of time does not lessen the problem. So in other words, it doesn't get any better just because it takes 6 billion or trillion years. You've still got the issue of what starts it? Where does it come from? What's the first beginning? And, well, it was a big bang. All right, so what banged? What exploded? Nothing? And, you know, the fact that people even talk this way, you know, the universe exploded out of nothing. What? What? Even Maria Van Trapp knows nothing comes from nothing. You know, or maybe it's the oldest daughter, I guess. She's the one who sings it. So, nothing comes from nothing. We all know that. Sound of Music, come on, get with it here. Got to have daughters who watch it incessantly, you know, through that little period of... What's that?
Maria does sing it.
Oh, she does too, yeah. Okay. But I think the daughter's first, though, doesn't she? The oldest one.
Have to watch it?
Yeah, yeah. All right, so... there has to be some sort of first beginning point. There has to be some first cause. Otherwise, you're left with this infinite regress. And philosophers have never been happy with an infinite regress because they say, well, that's absurd. Forever and ever, infinite regress to what? It's completely unacceptable. And we operate that way all the time. So he goes on to say, for it is not well known in physics that according to the law, or is it not well known, according to the law of atrophy, the second law of thermodynamics, motion tends to grow less and less in time, proceed from higher to lower forms, greater to lesser energy. Yet most evolutionary hypotheses suppose the opposite. So what's driving this? What's making it happen? And what you actually start to see in a lot of the literature is people start to cheat, and you start seeing evolution personified, and it almost takes on like a capital E, like it's doing stuff. You know, evolution is creative, and it tries new things, and it does things. No, it doesn't. It's not purposeful. It's not a being. It's nothing. And yet we talk that way because we're trying to provide the designer and provide the director to make things work because we've got to have that. And so if we don't have God, we've got to come up with something else. So that's the idea. All right, contingency. Clearly the idea is that there has to be something that is a first ground for everything. Everything can't be contingent on everything, everything, everything. There's got to be some beginning point, unmoved mover. Got to have something. And then we get to the moral kinds of thing here. Yeah, that's where we are. All right, well, enough of that. Before I get into that, anything else in the cosmological? All right. Yeah, go ahead, Merritt.
We say, you know, that God always was, always is. How? Because I've tried to talk to people where I'd say, use the watch in the woods idea, or, you know, specifically it was a phone sitting there. I'm like, do you think if I were putting that in the bag and shake it forever, it's ever going to come together perfectly and work? And they're like, well, it's totally different from nature, you know. I'm like, well,
it seems
like, yeah, exactly. But, you know, I've never heard someone that could be defeated by the idea of that infinite regress.
Like, that's because they haven't thought about it enough. I mean, the average person you're going to run into on a college campus or in, you know, just on an evangelism call has not thought seriously about the philosophical implications of infinite regress. They just haven't. And anybody who has finds it very troubling. That's why Aristotle thought about things and, you know, contingent, you can't go forever. There's got to be something. There's got to be a first mover. There's got to be a base. And so, like I said, any serious philosophical thinker really gets uncomfortable with the idea of an infinite regress. Doesn't like it. What you encounter most of the time, though, and you guys are going to see this very clearly, is most of the people you encounter know about this much science, and they assume that, well, science has disproven God, which is, it hasn't, but they make that assumption. And then you start trying to give them arguments, and they assume that, well, science, no, that can't be true. But they don't know. They haven't thought about it. They haven't thought about that. They haven't read the hard science, and they haven't thought about the hard philosophy. They just haven't done it. Because the fact is, the further you go in hard science and the further you go in philosophy, the more compelling these arguments become, not less. Yeah.
I just sort of think what I've encountered more than just not considering the infinite regress is saying that answering God doesn't solve the infinite regress. Just that, well, what caused God? If something doesn't cause everything, then...
Yeah, except for God. Well, that's why God's not part of the creation. He's not... See, if you start asking the question, what caused God, you've just reduced God from what he actually is and put him into the system. You made a Cartesian move. And so you need to say, wow, then he wouldn't be God if he was caused, would he? Done. I win, you lose. What's that? That's right. He'll be ready right then. Wow, baptize me, I believe. All right, good. All right, fourth category, arguments from conscience, beauty, pragmatic results. This is simply to say that we all have this sense of right and wrong, this kind of idea of conscience. Adultery, not a good thing. Incest, not a good thing. Murder, not a good thing. These are across the board, across cultures. Where does that sense of right and wrong come from? And the answer that even Kant came up with was God puts it there. Now, we can go even further and expand this a little bit more, that the very idea of being held accountable demands some kind of accountability to somebody greater than this world. And people actually want this. People want this, the sense of accountability, because what they don't want is someone like Hitler or Stalin getting off so easy as just being able to die and that's it. There's no hell for them. They want there to be justice. They need that. And we actually need, as I was trying to talk about before, if there is no God, and if there is no accountability, and if there is no eternal punishment or reward for what we are doing here, then why would anybody bother to be moral? Why? And you can make the argument, well, because it makes the world a better place. Who cares? If I'm dead and I'm not part of the world, what do I care? Well, do it for your children. What do I care? Why should I care about my children? With the bonds of love, so what? You know, I think about this. You know, if it's going to be really, you live and you die and that's it? That's it? And then what you get is most people just kind of the herd mentality. They just kind of go along with what they're supposed to because they don't know any better, and which is great for the world, and that's why Nietzsche loves the herd. But then you get the Übermensch who comes along and says, fine, I'll ride the herd and I'll do what I want. The guy who's got the guts and the brilliance to be able to just rise above it all. But that's what you get if there's really no God. People haven't thought about this very much. And they try to come up with reasons why we should be moral for the sake of the bettering of the world or for the sake of the culture or for these kinds of reasons. But all of them fall apart when you really press hard on, wait a minute, if it's purely I live, get 80 years, and that's it, what should I do with those 80 years then? Shouldn't I just find all the pleasure I possibly can? Doesn't that make the most sense? Why bother with anything else? And then when I get tired, why do I bother to live? Just be done with it. What's the point? And how can you even condemn a mass murderer as being wicked or evil? What's to say a guy going into a room and just shooting up a bunch of people is wrong? He just felt like it. So, what do you mean wrong? Why do you say it's wrong? Well, we all think it is. So what? Maybe you're all wrong. There's no wrong. Wrong, right? These are arbitrary. Just thoughts you have, feelings. They're not based on anything. You can't talk that way. No one thinks about this stuff. And so what we do as a culture, Nietzsche nailed this, is we just kind of live on the fumes of our Christian heritage and kind of assume that we have things that are right and wrong, but yet we say that, well, that stuff's not really true, but you better be good. Doesn't make any sense. Think about this a little bit. You'll see the point of what I'm making here. All right, good. So then we have conscience, talked about that. A little bit too much theodicy going on page 168. But we'll forgive him for that. And then we have these arguments from beauty. This is something that we have spent way too little time on in the church, and this is what we mean by aesthetics. Aesthetics is the question of beauty. Most of you have been raised to believe that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and that good art is all relative, and what you like, maybe someone else doesn't like, and it's just kind of relative, it depends on your taste, and some people like impressionism, some people like cubism, some people like, you know, photorealism, it just all depends on what you like. And so people go to the art museum and they walk around and say, I like that, I don't like that, and that's all we could do. All of this would have been just considered absolutely absurd in ancient Greece. Because everybody in ancient Greece knew that aesthetics are not arbitrary. Aesthetics are tied to truth. What is beautiful is what is true. And what is true is what coheres with the reality implanted into things by the Creator. So when man is fulfilling his telos, and for Aristotle that meant being what a human being is supposed to be, cultivating and developing and exhibiting the virtues which define full humanity, that's your telos. When a person is doing that, that's beautiful. That's aesthetically pleasing. That's good and true and right and beautiful. And things that are aberrant from that telos are therefore ugly. And see, everybody always knew this. even in the, you know, in the Victorian era, they actually had, you know, they did the phrenetics where they would study people's faces, and, you know, and eyes that were too close together meant bad things, you know, and chins and foreheads and all this kind of stuff, because they knew that somehow the aesthetics were actually tied to things. Now, maybe they went a little carried away, and we kind of laugh at it nowadays, but they were convinced of the connection. And we are nowadays just so far away from that we've forgotten that there are things that are inherently beautiful. This goes with all kinds of art. There is art that is false and is ugly, not even worth looking at. And there is music that is false and ugly and not even worth dealing with. And there is music that is beautiful, simply because it coheres with the will of God and the ways things are. And I'm not just talking about Christian lyrics stuck on stuff, okay? So this is the whole issue of aesthetics, and it's way underexplored and way understood, but we need to think about it more. The argument we're making then is that what is aesthetically beautiful is what coheres with the will of the Creator, and that sense of beauty must come from somewhere. And even the sense of the beauty in creation, you know, Odin talks about that. Why is this stuff there? This is page 169, last full paragraph. Some reductive naturalism has sought to account for beauty in terms of its evolutionary survival value. And this view makes some sense in relation to sexual selection. You know, beautiful people make better partners. But it seems far less plausible in explaining the beauty of inorganic life, like a beautiful rock or the sky, the ocean, the grandeur of mountains, or even the beauty of a flower. Why does a flower have to be beautiful for a bee to come to it? Okay? It has to smell like stuff. It seems as though there may be a profound intention at work in and through inorganic nature that it may be intrinsically beautiful and be perceived by any rational being as beautiful. For what other purpose or sufficient reason can one hypothesize the Grand Canyon has been so beautiful for so many millions of years, and there's a little Odin stuff coming through. We'll talk about that more later. Before human beings became belatedly to behold it. So there's a source for this beauty. It's got to be coming from somewhere. So page 170, he wraps this all up right in the middle of the last paragraph. Hence, if degrees of beauty exist, as our common language constantly assumes, then that which is unsurpassably beautiful or filled with the beauty of glory, the glory of beauty, must be posited in that we will call God. All right. Then he talks about the pragmatic argument, which he says on page 172 is a very modern argument. And basically what he's saying is that to believe in God makes life better, which it does. And psychological and sociological studies still bear this out, that people who believe in God and who are, you know, faithful in their religious devotion actually tend to be happier, have better lives, be more successful. It's just true. So if pragmatically, you know, raise your kids to be Christian, they're going to have a better life. There's truth to that. So that's the pragmatic argument, which is very American, and we're not really very thrilled with it, but it's true. Then there's this last argument he has, only a page given to this, page 173 to 174. Actually, it's less than a page, and that's the argument from congruity. And this is a really cool argument, I think, and I find this one really compelling. And there's kind of a parallel word that goes with this idea of congruity, and that would be parsimony. You know, parsimonious person is a cheap person, but parsimony means the simplest way out of something, the most economical way of doing something is what we mean by parsimony or the parsimonious explanation. So if you walk into your home and you've got a sandwich sitting on your table and out of the corner of it there's a chomp, a bite mark taken out of the corner. So what's the simple explanation? Well, it looks like my spouse came in and took a bite of my sandwich, or my kid did this. Or maybe what happened was somebody actually sneaked in from outside and they had a knife and they carved off that shape that looks like a little bit of, you know, a mouth shape, put a little bit of saliva in the corners, then he walked out with the piece. Or an alien came down and just burned it with laser and took that piece away. Is that possible? Sure. But what's the parsimonious explanation? I think my spouse took a bite of my sandwich, which is probably the most likely. So that's what we mean by congruity. You know, the simplest explanation is the most compelling. That's what's going on here. And so that's what he's talking about. This is actually, I think, very nicely said. Very bottom of 173. If God in fact exists, then the virtually universal belief in divine reality is accounted for. If God exists, then the intellectual hunger to ask for a first cause of causes is satisfied without the embarrassment of an infinite regress of causes. If God exists, a religious nature has an object. If God exists, natural law finds adequate explanation. If God exists, moral awareness is vindicated. So in other words, God solves all these problems, and the simplest way is God exists. Bam, everything falls into place. If God doesn't exist, you have to find a new explanation for all of these things. Where did our moral awareness come from? Where's the sense of beauty come from? Where's the congruity? You know, you got to come up with answers for all these things. Is it possible to come up with answers? Sure, you can do that. But eventually it starts to become like, come on. It's like, you know, you're talking about aliens beaming in and doing stuff. Come on. It just gets to a point where it gets kind of crazy. Whereas the simple, obvious, staring you in the face answer is, guess what? God exists, takes care of all this. That's a simple way out. That's the congruity, the parsimonious. Everything gets covered here. So his thesis then, that postulate which Bex explains the most distantly related facts is most probably true. So God accounts for all this stuff. Let's just take that and we've got it. All right. That brings us to the final argument. Yes?
Can we go back to aesthetics real quick?
Sure.
Would you argue that there's nothing more beautiful than the creation? Because all art is a reflection of the creation.
Well, you see, I don't want to get caught into a trap of best of all possible worlds. I would say this is the world that God created for us, and that the world that God created for us is beautiful because God created it to be beautiful. It has a lot of ugliness in it because of the fall, but it is a beautiful world. And so the creation is a reflection of the Creator in a sense, and so its beauty is derived from the Creator. But is it the most beautiful thing? I'm always hesitant on superlatives. It's beautiful because God created it, but I wouldn't be hesitant to say this is the most beautiful possible thing. I don't want to go there because I don't want to get caught into the trap of this is the best of all possible worlds. God wouldn't have made anything less than the best of all possible worlds, because I would say, well, he certainly could have. Could God give us a B world instead of an A world? Sure. You know, there might be an A world somewhere that's even better than ours. Who knows? That's conceivable. So I think that's a mistake. We'll talk about this more in a week. But it's a mistake that gets made a lot by a lot of people in the scientific community to assume that God would have to create the best of all possible worlds. And obviously this isn't, so what's that say? But the assumption is that this is the best of all possible worlds. Who says? It doesn't have to be. We might even have a C world. You know, maybe there's better ones out there. Possible. All right. Final arguments. Ontological argument. Argument from being. So you read through this. I don't know how much more I can expand on it. People either find this sublimely beautiful, like Odin, and he's probably like 0.5% of the population, or they find it like, huh? And it's, you know, kind of how people usually react to this. But the ontological argument is essentially the question of being, and probably the most important part of the argument, at least in my thinking, and everybody's kind of different on this, but the thing for me, the critical thing is the definition of God. That's the critical move. So if we're going to define God as Anselm does, and as everybody else does, that than which nothing greater can be conceived. Okay, if that's our definition of God, that than which nothing greater can be conceived, well then by definition, that thing has to exist, or it wouldn't be the greatest possible thing that could be conceived. And the reason you can say this about God and not an island or the perfect, you know, person is because those things are finite and their existence is not dependent upon the definition. Whereas the definition of God as that in which nothing greater can be conceived demands the reality to be there, or you don't have it right. And if somebody says, well, I can think of a God, and think of the most perfect God doesn't mean he has to exist, and then my answer would be, then you haven't defined him rightly. You've diminished him, and you have less than what God actually is because your definition is insufficient. Now, that's kind of the crux of it. So, and like I said, it doesn't do much good to talk about it more. It's just one of those things you kind of get your mind around, and either you are convinced by it and find it compelling, or you don't. I've never yet used the ontological argument in any discussion in my life, and I don't think I ever will, but maybe you will.